Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
To the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, our quote for the day from Ken Hubbard, 1868 to 1930. It is pretty hard to tell what does bring happiness. Poverty and wealth have both failed. How about friendships and family and believing in something bigger than yourself? Anyhow, welcome to our program, my friends, our patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice. Believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy Fat Tuesday. Happy Mardi Gras. Stephen Eichler is on the line with us. He's the founder and president of FaxDC, FAXDC.com, the website. And the question he asks, are socialists disarming America? Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's a great privilege.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Your question raises two questions. The first is, what does socialism have to do with disarming people?
That's a great point. Socialism has a history of control of democracy. Obviously, socialism displaces democracy, so the people have no voice.
Well, wait a minute. You're talking about communism.
Have no choice.
You're talking about communism, as the word socialism as it was used by the communists in the Soviet Union. But I think most Americans these days get it that those nations of Europe that call themselves socialist, like France, like Germany, like Sweden, like Denmark, like Finland, have very little in common to do with the Soviet Union.
Well, actually, communism is an extreme form of socialism, as we all know that. Socialism says, let's take away the rights of the people, let's take away their freedoms, let's put democracy in the backseat. What socialism is an overreaching of the federal government.
Now, wait a second. Socialism doesn't say, let's take away the rights of the people. Socialism says that the rights of the people, the ability of people to start a business, the ability to live a decent life, the ability to survive into old age, the ability to survive sickness, those abilities only flourish most effectively in the soil of a strong commons. Socialism does not seek to take away any rights that have to do with the free market, beyond using the free market to the extent that the free market is using the commons, saying, you know, you're going to have to pay for those roads that you use. You're going to have to pay for the public education that you use. You're going to have to pay for the police department that you're going to use. You're going to have to pay for the fire department that you're going to use. But beyond that, socialism, as in democratic socialism, as is practiced in Europe and Japan and many other countries, instead enhances freedom by giving people this basis.
Think you're off base on that. Socialism does not enhance democracy, does not enhance the people. It is empowering the federal government to change the will of the people and telling the people, well, we think this is the best, or we think in your good interest, we're going to go ahead and enact this law or this type of legislation. I believe.
You mean like the war in Iraq?
By the people.
You mean like the war in Iraq?
The war in Iraq, if you want to get on that issue, was a misplaced war headed in the wrong direction, pushing the United States into a war that we did not know, meaning we the people did not know the consequences of what it would do on the national scale and right down to the local scale.
Well, actually, I think a lot of us were predicting it with fair accuracy, but my point is that the war in Iraq did nothing to advance the commons. It did nothing to advance those things that make life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness possible in the United States. Whereas there are a number of things that do, and since you want to talk specifically about gun control, and we'll get to that in just a minute, because you guys are opposed to the Brady Campaign, bradycampaign.org, and your website, factsdc.com. The whole point of the Commons is let's provide a baseline for support for people. It's the reason that we had bankruptcy laws. You know, Henry Ford declared bankruptcy seven times. Our bankruptcy laws go back to the founding of this country. And the reason why is because if somebody – we want somebody to be able to step out there on the edge of the ice and take an incredible chance. And if the ice cracks and they fall, we, the rest of the people, are going to catch them so that they can try it again. We want to encourage risk-taking. We want to encourage entrepreneurialism. And we've destroyed a lot of that with our bankruptcy laws. But no, I think it's all of one thing. It's all of saying what's the best thing for society. And to bring it around to guns – for example, you know, the early debate in the United States about guns had nothing to do with the right of the average person to carry or bear a gun. And bearing a gun, let's keep in mind, is actually walking around with that gun, which is a very different thing from keeping a gun. The first iteration, as I'm sure you're familiar, this was August 17th, 1787, the first iteration of the Bill of Rights, what became the Second Amendment, said a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people being the best security of a free state. The right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, but no one religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. What the founders were trying to do was make sure, as Jefferson said, he would get the Virginia delegation to veto the Bill of Rights if it wasn't in it. He eventually backed down. Was to veto a standing army in the United States. In fact, when Jefferson became president, there were 600,000 men at arms. I'm sorry, 300,000 men at arms. And when he left the presidency, there were just slightly over 3,000. Because he believed, as many of the founders did, we should not have a standing army during time of peace. Instead, we should have, like the Swiss have, where every able-bodied man between the ages of 17 and 47, which was the numbers that the founders put forward, should have a gun in their home and should be trained in the use of that gun and should be sworn as a member of a militia. Now, it's a very different thing than what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, you've made my point. First of all, I'd like to move back for one second here and take a look at your statement about bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is the extension of democracy. The people have decided if you are going to take a risk, we're going to allow a safety valve. So if you can't make your bills, if you get over your head, we're going to allow that so that you can be free. It's a promotion of freedom.
Right,
of being
and it's the company. Same argument for national health care.
Correct.
Absolutely. So you must agree with me on national health care.
In addition to that, you now have the land of the long guns, which is Switzerland. One of the reasons why Switzerland was not invaded in World War II is because every army knew that everyone in Switzerland had a long gun, a rifle, pistol, firearm of some nature in their house, and it would be street to street, house to house fighting. So you've made my point.
I'm agreeing with you on that, and I'm saying, although that's only part of it. I mean, the main reason Hitler never invaded Switzerland is because they were his banker. But nonetheless, had he tried to invade, and because they're surrounded by mountains and it's a hell of a difficult country, at least the major cities to get to, but had he actually invaded Switzerland, you're right, he would have encountered that kind of a problem. And that's the kind of military that our founders wanted to have. But they wanted there to be a regulation of that militia. Every single one of those people who owned a gun was responsible to a local leader of the militia who was responsible to an initiate. It started with a ward, and then they were accountable to a county commissioner, and they were accountable to the state. And, mm-hmm. and as a consequence of that, there was very strong regulation of those weapons. The question, I guess, in essence is if – the purpose of a gun when used as directed causes death, right? Or can cause death.
No, absolutely not. Well, when a firearm used as directed results in safety, does not result.
Well, you could argue that if it's used as a threat, but if you pull the trigger, and you know, I mean, I use firearms all the time, and I shoot paper targets, and I don't cause death. So, you know, we can argue the subtleties of this, but the point of it is that a firearm is designed to kill people. If we're going to take
a
device,
a firearm's not designed to kill people, not at all. Not at all. You're telling me that a black powder
kill or wound people. But here's my let me get to the larger question, because we only have a minute left here. The larger question is, if a device that at some level is designed in some way to kill or wound people, should not be regulated. Why do we regulate a 6,000-pound piece of steel that you can propel down the street at 60 miles an hour?
That's a darn good question. Let me answer that. You have a man get behind an automobile, in an automobile behind the wheel, and drives into a crowd deliberately. He's a nutcase. He's insane. But you take the same man and you hand him a firearm, and he shoots the same amount of people in that crowd. Now it's the gun's fault. It's a transfer of guilt. That's what the American people
I'm not saying it's the gun's fault. I'm saying if he had been licensed, it would be the licensor's fault. Why not license firearms just the same way we do cars?
Oh, absolutely not. It's very simple. I believe
you want any crazy to be able to walk in off the street and buy a gun?
I believe that we should expand freedom. We should expand liberty, not constrict, not keep liberty, justice, and the right to bear arms away from the people.
How about the ability to spray cocaine in somebody's face and get them high?
That is an obvious felony. That is a deliberate.
But see, that's not as deadly as shooting them with a gun. Well, you want to stick around for a second? We'll continue this conversation.
I'd love to.
Okay, I don't want to cut you off. Let's continue.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He drank his first strong liquor, then to calm his shaking hand, and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down, and he heard again his mother's words: "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." Bill with rage, then Billy Joe reached for his gun to draw. But the stranger drew his gun and fired before he even saw. As Billy Joe fell to the floor, the crowd all gathered round and wondered at his final words: "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town."
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Stephen Eichler, J.D., an attorney, is with us. He is the president and founder of FactsDC.com and going up against BradyCampaign.org, saying these socialists want to take away your guns. Steve, I hate when I've got some kind of a zinger line or an ending point in it, and I get the last word, and I just don't feel it's quite fair, so I tossed that in as we were going into the break. I just couldn't help myself. I'm sorry, I had too much coffee this morning.
Your show.
Well, it is, but I really genuinely try to have a fair conversation in this show. So here's the question. First of all, you're acknowledging that the founders did not want to have an unlimited right to own weapons. You're acknowledging that they didn't want women to own weapons, they didn't want children to own weapons, and they didn't want dissenters, people who didn't want to dissent to own weapons. And in fact, they didn't want people to own weapons by right of law who didn't agree to be part of the military. Are you with me so far? I'm assuming that you've read early American history and you're with me so far on that.
I've read early American history, but I'm not with you in one drop. You're begging the question. The question that the audience really wants to hear is, does every person in the United States, should they have the right to possess a firearm? The answer is no. Of course not. If the court comes out and says condition of your pardon or the court restriction of a individual's right to bear a firearm, that is the only reason why a person should not have a firearm in their possession. A court order.
By a firearm, let's establish some common ground here first. By a firearm, we're talking about something less than a fully automatic weapon, less than a 50 caliber machine gun, less than a surface-to-air shoulder-fired missile, something that can take down an airplane. We're not talking about that stuff, right?
We're talking about a gun.
We're talking about hunting rifles and pistols, basically.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Secondly, If the value of these things outside of a military context, which, again, I hope we agree was what the founders were all about, was using them in a military context. But if the value of these things outside of a military context and outside of a sports context, because, as I said, I'm a sports shooter. Every time I go back to Michigan, my brother Steve and I go down to the shooting range. In fact, last time my brother John and my nephew Tyler went along with us. And, you know, I rented a 44, a Glock 44, and had a great old time. And I'm getting pretty damn good with the thing, in fact. And
glad to hear it.
And boy, does that have a kick.
you know it.
And my kids have all, you know, used firearms appropriately on a range. You know, I've been through the training. I'm an NRA member. But purely recreationally. I've never hunted in my life. I have no interest in killing anything. I just find, you know, toys for boys. I find it fun to fire a gun. But the bottom line is that these things are weapons. They are weapons that can be used to either threaten or injure or kill. We're in agreement?
No, we're not.
What are they,
we're
toys?
We're not in agreement. You classify them as weapons. I classify them as...
Well, that's what my instructor required me to call them. He said, when you set down your weapon, and I said, you mean my gun, and he said, your weapon! Excuse me.
Well, when you're using that as a weapon, if I were to come at somebody with a baseball bat, now that's a weapon. So what you're really saying is, simply because it's a firearm, it's a gun, it is only used as a weapon, and I totally disagree with you. You made my point. You go out, you use it for target practice, for recreation. You teach your children how to be responsible.
But see, in Michigan, if I want to own a gun, and my brother owns several, and his significant other owns several, and when we go together to the firing range, they both have licenses for those guns. I don't. I don't own a gun, and so I have to rent one, but I have to prove that I'm competent to rent the thing, you know, show my training and whatnot. But here's the question. If somebody had, you know, a friend of mine died tragically of HIV a while back, and so I can't, you know, ask him for some of his blood, but let's say I could and get some anticoagulated HIV blood and put it in a 5cc syringe and walk around with that in a holster on my shoulder, it could be conceivably as deadly as at least at close range, maybe a little .22 pistol. Where do we draw the line in the weapons that we're going to use, or for that matter, a knife, something like that? I mean, isn't there an appropriate point at which we say things that are designed to kill or maim or threaten should be regulated outside of the military usage, which in my opinion was what the founders had in the mind, the Second Amendment, should be subject to regulation by we the people? Because we've got a situation in this country right now where lots and lots of people, over 33,600 people, died of weapons fire last year. You got about 15 seconds to answer it, Steve. I'll give you the last word.
Okay, no problem. We answered that on our website at factsdc.com, and what we said on that is that it's the intent. Anything can be used as a weapon, whether it's a firearm, a stick, a knife, a bottle, whatever, and it's the intent. That's why we have our court of law to be able to sort that out and also to guarantee our rights to own a firearm or decide not to own.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
An old man when you're living by the gun, and 35's a wise man whose back is to the sun. Another man lays dying face down in the street. The last thing he remembers is that gunslinger speed. Gunslinger, gunslinger, something to prove. Gunslinger.
Defending democracy from the weapons, the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, I'm going to pick up your calls here in just a second on this topic, but I just wanted to bring you up to date on some of the news here. Gary Locke, who was for two terms the governor of Washington before Christine Gregoire. This was before I moved out to the Pacific Northwest. I've only lived out in the Pacific Northwest for the last four, 4 years and change. And by the way, I mentioned yesterday our free live video cam. The Tom Vision is not working this week. I'm in New York through Wednesday. I'll be in Washington, D.C. Thursday and Friday, and the Tom Vision's back in our studios on in Portland. So my apologies to those of you who've sent me notes saying, hey, it looks like it's off. Anyhow, Gary Locke, the former governor of Washington State, looks like he's going to be the guy that the Bush administration is going to put forward to replace Judd Gregg, who replaced Bill Richardson, who was the original nominee of the Obama administration, for Commerce Secretary. And, you know, the good news of this is that as governor of Washington State, he was very involved. He's also of Asian ancestry, I believe Chinese ancestry, Chinese American. He, as governor of Washington State, he was very, very involved in and has a good understanding of international trade issues, particularly as they involve the Pacific Rim. That's also, in my opinion, the bad news. We have, in my humble opinion, Hillary Clinton over in the Middle East, or in the Far East, rather, singing the tune of, doing the dance of the transnational corporations, justifying her husband's embrace of corporate free trade policies. And these corporate free trade policies, in my opinion, have sold us down the tubes. They have just absolutely sold us down the tubes. Tariffs on imported cars into Taiwan, into South Korea, into China, into Japan can run as high as, in some cases, 80%, particularly when you consider all the other trade barriers they put in place. There are no barriers to bringing things into the United States. And that's just one example. And my understanding is that Gary Locke is a free trader. I was talking with this, with Kari Chisholm of BlueOregon.com this morning and with Carl Wolfson, my co-host on AM 620 KPOJ. Who both have much more familiarity with him than I do. And Kari was saying, this guy is a solid so-called free trader. And corporate free trade, in my humble opinion, is one of the things that really got us into this mess. It may be, along with the Iraq War, the only thing about which I agree with Pat Buchanan, but I do strongly. And I, you know, maybe with Hilda Solis, there will be a balance, there will be a team of rivals. But I don't know. You know, the head of the Commerce Department, in my opinion, should be somebody who is in favor of commerce that builds and defends the commercial interests of the United States of America, not the transnational corporations, many of which are domiciled in the United States and call themselves American corporations, but in fact are not making American products, they're not hiring American workers, they're simply using us as a consumer base. So we'll see how this goes forward, and what's going to be particularly interesting is if in Gary Locke's confirmation hearings, assuming he's the guy, in his confirmation hearings, if anybody has the courage to raise these kind of questions. So we'll see. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Tony in Arcata, California. Hey, Tony, listening on KGOE. What's on your mind, Tony?
Well, your guest made your point, actually, when he brought up Switzerland. As I understand it, every adult male in Switzerland is required to be in the military reserve and have a rifle and train regularly. So,
that's right. In fact, they have to have a certificate that demonstrates that they're competent.
Yeah, so they have a de facto well-regulated militia. It's just not willy-nilly. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I had to say. Oh, and
okay.
This phrase, you're making my point, it seems to be, I don't know, I've noticed it coming up a lot. I think it might be a new right-wing argument method. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome, Tony. When they lack anything else, they say you're making my point, as if somebody were, actually. I don't think I was. Garth in Kansas City. Hey, Garth, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, first of all, I just want to say you're one of the most intelligent people on the radio I've heard in a long time, and I appreciate it. I hate the fact that Sirius only gets 1 hour of your program. But anyway, first thing, first comment I heard from this guy, and one of the things I hear from the right all the time, is they merge the lines between socialism and democracy when one is an economic policy and one's a political philosophy.
Yeah, that was my point. If he's using socialism in the context of communism, you know, that's theoretically an economic system, but it became a political system. Socialism, as it's practiced in Europe, is by
social
and large
democracy.
Social democracy is an economic policy, and it's one, by the way, that works very well. I was just boggled the other day. I was watching an interview on one of the cable shows, and one of these right-wing politicians, a Republican politician, he goes, well, the rest of Europe is melting down as bad as we are. In fact, some of them are even worse. Well, it's really only true. I mean, you know, certainly some of the old former Soviet states like Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia are basket cases, but they've arguably always been basket cases. They're still dealing with the hangover of being a former Soviet state. But the ones that are really going down the tubes are Ireland and the United Kingdom. Why? Because they embraced Thatcherism in 1978. Just as Reagan was coming into office in 81, and or maybe it was 79 that Thatcher came into power, and Thatcherism and Reaganomics, essentially the same thing, and it's destroyed the UK countries as much as it's destroyed us. There are some, you know, they're clearly having some problems in some of the southern countries, in Spain and Italy and whatnot, but nothing like what we're talking about here and nothing like what we're talking about in the UK. And the northern countries, the socialist countries, and keep in mind, Berlusconi's been basically running Italy for the last couple of decade and a half anyway, and running it in a very right-wing fashion. Spain has had a long history of right-wing governments going all the way back to Franco. But the countries that are small s socialist, small d democratic, are the countries that are doing quite well, thank you very much.
Yeah, and also on the gun issue, the thing that I never understood about the NRA is why they are so against regulating guns used by children, when we have the example of the 11-year-old that has a rifle built for an 11-year-old that shoots his father's girlfriend in the head when... And yet the NRA still refuses to regulate those guns.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that in 2005, the last year that we have reliable statistics for, in the United States, 30,694 people died of firearm-related deaths. 12,352 of them were murdered. 17,000 killed themselves. That's more than the number who were murdered. And 789 were accidents, 333 by police intervention, and an unknown 221. And I remember when I was 19, I think, my best friend Clark Stinson through high school went off and joined the Army, or maybe his draft number got pulled. I don't frankly remember, but he joined the Army, came back during Christmas right after boot camp, and was just totally depressed. He was going to be sent off to Vietnam. And, you know, I think, frankly, if he didn't have a gun at home, he could have gotten through that depression. I mean, you know, a number of us tried to talk with him. I really think if it hadn't been so convenient, but instead he grabbed a gun and he stuck it in his mouth and blew his brains all over the back of his wall. And his wife and I discovered him. And I'm telling you, suicide by gun is, you know, just having had that personal experience of it, I would have to guess that at least a third of the people who commit suicide by gun wouldn't do so if they didn't have a gun handy. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm just pulling that number out of my own experience. I don't have any science to back it up, but I know it's a number. I know, there's some number out there, whatever it is.
I think Canada's suicide rate's probably lower than ours, and that's based on somewhat on their regulation of guns.
Yeah, at least handguns. They have more rifles than we do, but it's a little more difficult to shoot yourself with a rifle. And in the city, they don't have rifles, and the cities are the major population centers. So, good point. Garth, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
thanks,
it. Great to hear from you. Stuart in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Stuart, what's up?
Hey, well, according to your guest, I guess your friend might have hurt himself with a baseball bat instead, but that wasn't my point. I'm an ace target shooter, and I would have no qualms about hunting for food if I was in that position in terms of, like, where I lived, say. But
I wouldn't either if it was a survival situation, but it's not.
Exactly.
So I have no interest in watching something die. I mean, I just don't want it.
Yeah, and exactly. And you did a good job of trying to nail him down on the original intent of the fathers, but he never really went for that. But the point is what he and all the other gun nuts always ignore is they always ignore the well-regulated militia part of the Second Amendment. They
right.
just ignore that every time. They always say right to bear arms. They forget about the first part, and you need to keep it simple and always hammer away at that. What's a well-regulated militia?
Yeah, you're right.
I mean,
you know, Thomas Jefferson, in a letter that he wrote to James Madison in his objection to a standing army and his demand for that, what became the Second Amendment, he said, and I'm paraphrasing this from memory, but I think it's word for word. He said, I hope I shall never live to see the day when the young men of my country are willing to be shot at for a sixpence.
Bye. And
And
don't forget, Jesus was an economic communist, not a political communist.
Yeah, there you go. And what do we have now? We've got people joining the army because it's the employer of last resort. Our young men are willing to be shot at for a sixpence. Jefferson's nightmare has come true. What a tragedy. Back with your calls, 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, that was me when I was 4 years old, anyway. Welcome back. Strange stuff going on in the world. Some would say downright crazy. I think you can tie this into the whole gun debate. This Jonathan Lee Riches has filed a $23 million lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Richmond, Virginia, stating that his long criminal record was caused, which, by the way, a long laundry list of criminal activity from illegally obtaining credit cards to attend NASCAR races, to using stolen credit cards to purchase products hawked by NASCAR race drivers, including Kyle Petty's being sponsored by a Viagra. He was using stolen credit cards to buy a Viagra. And his frequent speeding tickets, including going 135 miles an hour. He says it's all the fault of NASCAR. Watching it on TV made him do it. It influenced him. So maybe we should be suing, what, Gunsmoke? Bruce Willis? I don't know. Come on. Oh, man. See, this is the point. I mean, there is a rational point in all this. And I can just see some conservative right now going, oh, can you imagine? There must be some liberal who's doing that lawsuit and saying that. No, it's a crazy guy. It's a crazy guy. Oh, my. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Dan in Portland. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? First off, I want to say that I consider myself a socialist, pretty much, and certainly any conservative on the planet would agree with me. Also, I'm what many on the left would call a gun nut, so I'm kind of a rare animal here.
Mm-hmm.
But in all that I've read and studied, nowhere is it written that gun control and gun confiscation is a cornerstone of socialism. So I want to throw that out to all the conservatives who might be listening.
Although it was a cornerstone of communism. I mean, Stalin took the guns, and it was a cornerstone of Nazism,
too. Yeah, that's the thing, though.
It's a cornerstone of totalitarianism.
Right, exactly. And something that you said earlier about regulating guns like cars, I would say that in many states, Oregon being one of them, it kind of is regulated like a car, where mm-hmm. you can own a gun without a license. You can own a car without a license.
Yep.
If you want to take your car out on the street, you got to have a license. If you want to take your gun out with you, concealed, you got to have a license.
Yep.
Something else you might bring up to Senator Sanders on Friday is, as you may well know, having lived in Vermont concealed carry laws allow you to carry a concealed handgun without a license.
There are no concealed carry laws in Vermont. I mean, it's just that simple. You can carry anything you want. In fact, you can walk down the street with a holster with a 45 sitting in it, a six shooter.
The real issue, not so much being guys like us having guns, it's the criminals having guns. So I think the real issue of gun control shouldn't be prohibition, because we all know that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The real issue should be heavier regulations on dealers, making sure that they aren't allowing guns to slip through the cracks.
Yeah.
The real issue is...
Well, let me step it back one
social,
more.
Heavy
regulation on manufacturers and wholesalers, who are the people
right.
who largely fund the National Rifle Association. By the
on the supply end, needs to be regulated. We also need social changes in this country that help people who otherwise might live a life of crime, who help them get on the right track. We need health care. We need job security. We need all the things that are causing poverty and causing the strife in the world. That's what we need to work on. We could spend millions and billions of dollars trying to ban 15-round magazines and go through all this other stuff, but the factor is it's a waste of time and money and effort trying to ban or over-regulate the tool that is used and without addressing the underlying causes. I mean, you could treat symptoms all day long, but if you don't cure the disease, it's never going to go away. We need to focus on social reforms. We need to focus on getting our society back onto a track where, you know, you could walk down the street and assume everybody has a gun and not fear them.
Yeah.
Because it's not the gun, it's the guy that's holding it. And our country is a breeding ground for criminals of all sorts. And that's where I got to leave it.
Well,
thanks,
okay.
Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. She's gone. Let's see here. Ed, by the way, you could consider Vicodin. Or, you know, what was the drug that Limbaugh was? I guess he was addicted to several. But, you know, consider one of the narcotic drugs, you know, OxyContin. This is a drug that, you know, has a legitimate use. And you can say guns have legitimate uses. It's also a substance that can be abused. In fact, it can cause death. And so at the distribution level, at the wholesale distribution level, it is heavily regulated. And at the manufacturing, it is heavily regulated. And that is what the gun lobby is hysterical about. That's what they don't want to have happen. Ed in West Virginia. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show. I'm a Democrat member of the NRA.
Mm-hmm.
I just have two points to make. One is on licensing. I think if the government came out with a licensing program, as they did with the commercial airline pilots under a federal flight deck officer program, even those commercial airline pilots had problem getting licensed because they couldn't pass the psychiatric exam.
Hmm.
I don't feel the average citizen would have any chance. Plus, the bureaucracy and the paperwork involved would be a nightmare.
Yeah, although I think it should be done at the state level, not the federal level. My personal take on it. I'd rather have the states licensing weapons. And you know, I think that that acknowledges that the requirements of Washington, D.C. and New York City are quite different from rural Vermont. But your point is well made, Ed, and I appreciate your giving us a shout and sharing it with us. We do have to acknowledge that there are differences in areas. And there are differences in the way that weapons are used. And there are differences in cultures that seem to encourage or discourage crime. Coming up next, Tony Blankley. He says, yes, we need censorship.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Well, have the terrorists won? Has Bin Laden gotten what he wanted? Is he about to get what he wants? In my humble interpretation, Tony Blankley, in his new book, American Grit, What It Will Take to Survive and Win in the 21st Century, the executive vice president of Edelman Public Relations in Washington, D.C., former editorial page editor of the Washington Times, press secretary of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, my former member of Congress, and the website AmericanGritBook.com. Facebook.com says so. Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on.
Great to have you back with us here in American Grid in Chapter 5, in praise of censorship. And you started right out many years ago in a classic essay, Irving Kristol, and you go through this whole thing about, and in Chapter 6, A Law Code for Wartime. It seems to me that the argument that you are making in praise of censorship in the United States is one that, A, when we've tried it in the past, was flawed. We're still condemning John Adams for what he did with the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1788 and 1789. And we're still condemning Woodrow Wilson for what he did during World War I. And many are still condemning, I will still condemn Franklin Roosevelt for what he did in turning the Japanese and many of his limits on freedom of speech during World War II.
As you know, because you obviously read my chapter, I have a very limited definition of what I want to censor, and it is the release during wartime of classified information that risks operations in the field. And the examples are the New York Times about a month and a half ago, since the book was published, but other examples before that I cite, released for the first time the classified information that the Bush administration was trying to sabotage Iran's nuclear program. By publishing that story, they ended the ability to sabotage Iran's nuclear program without having to go to war with Iran.
You know, I reported on that story 2 years ago, Tony. We had people from Iran on this show who were talking about how the MEC forces, the Iranian insurgency forces, were being funded by the United States. They had tracked the funding back through the Swiss banks and through the bank in Iraq.
Well,
that was no secret.
The funding story was broken by the New York Times a couple of years ago when they admitted that a secret monitoring of Treasury money was legal, but they reported it anyway, and subsequently that program broke down. There have been a series of releases of dangerous classified information. Now, what you're talking about regarding Wilson and John Adams and Roosevelt was sedition laws, which said that you can't publicly oppose policies. I obviously don't argue for that. I oppose policies every day. I exercise my First Amendment rights, and I heartily encourage everybody to do so. I don't think that's the same as reporting classified war secrets.
Well, first of all, there are some things that we need to keep secret. I think we can agree on that. And
well, we
have strong laws to keep those things secret. I mean, back in the 80s when I owned an ad agency, I did some work for the National Security Agency, and I had to sign like 16 pages worth of documents. I was working inside the NSA office. Every time I walked into a room, a red light went off, you know, that this guy's not an employee. I mean, I get it that there are secrets, that there are some things that you just don't take out of the building. There are some things you don't tell people.
But the question is, the question is, what happens if somebody does take it out?
They get prosecuted.
Well,
we have very strong laws to prosecute. I'm telling you, I read those laws. I know what I could have been subject to if I said what I had been doing.
Well, I understand that if we catch the government employee releasing the information, we can prosecute them. But the history of leaks, as you well know, is not a very successful one. Very often information is leaked and you can't find the person.
Then let's take it to the larger picture, Tony. If we want...
The only person you can find is the person who publishes it. You can't hide publishing it in the New York Times. You can often hide leaking information. That's what Washington's substantially in the business of doing.
Well, let me take a completely contrarian view then. Let me suggest to you that to the extent that we have become a more closed society, and that you are an advocate of that we are doing exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted us to do.
If you want to make that argument, you can. That's not what my book's about. That's not what that chapter's about. But if you want to argue that I'm in favor of a closed society...
I said a more closed society.
No, then that's a different book than the one I've written. I mean, I don't know what book that is. I talk about individual freedom. Other than prosecuting the publication of classified war secrets, where am I suggesting a closed society? I mean,
well, my problem is your definition of war. You're saying that we're at war right now.
Well,
I don't recall Congress declaring war, and the Constitution says the only body that has the authority to declare war is Congress.
You don't think we're in a war in Iraq and Afghanistan right now?
I do not.
We've lost 4,300 men, troops, in Iraq. They died during war. There are still troops going to war. I have a son in the Army. If you don't think we're in war now, then I don't understand the concept of war.
I think that a war is when you are defending your nation. What we are involved in, you know, we euphemistically called it a police action in Vietnam.
I mean,
I would say what we are involved in right now are war crimes. but not war.
I mean, that really, that's semantics. If you want,
it is not semantics. Semantics is when you are defending your nation. Our nation is not at risk from, was not at risk from Saddam Hussein, and is not right now at risk from the average Iraqi citizen. And the extent
to, if you want to say that you oppose the war, fine. But the fact is, the United States is at war. The president is leading the war.
Who are we at war with?
The Congress authorized the war. The Congress funded the war.
With whom are we at war?
Men and women are dying in battle against something that they call the enemy. If you say that's not a war, you're saying you don't like the war.
With whom are we at war, Tony?
What?
With whom are we at war?
Well, in Iraq, we're at war with the insurgents. In Afghanistan, we're at war with the Taliban and with al-Qaeda. And that's now leaking into Pakistan.
So in Iraq, we are at war, using your definition, with the people whose country illegally occupied. I don't consider that a war. War connotes some sort of legitimacy. That's completely illegitimate, in my opinion.
There are rules of war.
There are laws of war.
The United Nations has ratified war as
something that is legal when necessary.
Let's go back and analyze what you just said. You said war. What was that? You said war has to be. What was the phrase you used?
In defense of your nation. There are clear definitions of what is a legitimate war.
When Hitler invaded Poland, was that a war just because it was unjust?
That was an invasion. That was not a war.
I don't know what dictionary you use, but when two countries are fighting each other with their troops, historically we call that a war.
Here's why I'm trying to make this distinction, Tony. If we were in a if we were in World War II against Hitler or against Tojo, if we were against an enemy that was really and truly trying to occupy the United States and destroy us, somebody who presented a clear and present danger against the United States, then I would be in favor of saying, anything that has to do with secrecy around that, to the extent that it might cause us to lose that effort, yes, absolutely, we need strong laws about that. But with regard to Iraq, that is an occupation, an illegal occupation of another country. And if the New York Times publishes some information that causes that occupation to end sooner, now I'm not in favor of it causing the death of any American citizens, and neither are you, and I think we can agree on that.
That'll be the side effect of giving our war plan.
Not if we get the hell out of the way.
Well, look, this isn't a discussion about war. This is a discussion about you don't like the Iraq war, which is a good discussion to
have. It's
not
a war.
It has nothing to do with the concept of a war.
It is not a war. It's an offensive action. It is an offensive war crime.
Well, let me ask you this. What about the Civil War? Should Abraham Lincoln – the North was not invaded. Should he have fought the Civil War, or was that a bad war too, an unjust war too?
That is a classic. You're using my classic definition of war.
I know,
if we are at risk, we defend ourselves.
If you followed your theory, I understand.
Lincoln, by the way, clamped down on civil liberties as well.
I understand that you probably thought of the Civil War as a war of northern aggression, which at some technical level it was. And if your theory had been followed through, there wouldn't be a United States of America. There would be a northern colonies, a northern country, and a southern country.
No, you just turned what I said 180 degrees upside down. I said the Civil War was an actual war because the states of the South, which declared that war, declared war against the United States of America, and we were at risk.
No, they didn't. All they did was take back their own.
Well, they initiated the physical action. You could argue that Lincoln issued the formal declaration of war.
The North initiated the invasion of the South. The South only wanted to secede. They wanted to leave. The North said you couldn't, and the North then invaded the South and conquered them. That was so the North, on your basis, would not have been justified in fighting the war.
Tony, I may well have to give you that. I will be the first to admit I'm not a scholar of the Civil War, but the bottom line is that the security, the future, the integrity of this country was at risk, and that is not the case in Iraq.
I agree with you on that.
And that is not the case in Iraq.
That's your opinion.
Yeah. Well, right? It is my opinion, absolutely, and yours differs from that, therefore our conversation. Tony, you also suggest in the book that you want to bring back a draft. Can you stick around for another 10 minutes?
Sure, absolutely.
I would love to have a conversation with you about this because we may find some common ground here, or maybe not. I don't know. We'll see how it shakes out. I find your book interesting, though. We're talking with Tony Blankley, his new book, American Grit, What It'll Take to Survive and Win in the 21st Century.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been wandering through this land, doing the best I can, trying to find what I was meant to do. And the people that I see look as worried as can be, and it looks like they are wondering too. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, or where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. And I had a buddy back home, but he started out to roam. And I hear he's out by Frisco Bay. And sometimes when I've had a few, his old voice comes a-ringing through. And I'm going out to see him some old day. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, or where I'm bound.
Tom Hartman here with you.
Can't help but wonder where
helping you win the water cooler wars. And Tony Blankley on the line with us. His new book, American Grit, What It'll Take to Survive and Win in the 21st Century. And, Tony, the website is AmericanGritBook.com. Do I have that right?
No, I think it's Amazon.com. I don't think there's a separate website
yeah.
for it.
Okay. Well, that'll work, yeah. Or you know, your favorite bookseller, wherever it may be, Powell's.com or whatever, Barnes & Noble. And of course, let's support our local bookstores. You and I, both authors and both fans
absolutely.
Of bookstores.
Absolutely. If you have a local bookstore, go there, because I love to browse myself.
Oh, I'm a junkie, man. You get me into I live in Portland. You get me into Powell's, and I'm doomed. You know, 4 hours later, I'm walking out with three bags of books, and my wife is looking at me like, oh, no.
Yeah, I take my 11-year-old daughter every Saturday morning. We go to the bookstore and browse for books and bring home a few.
That's what my parents did every weekend. We used to.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's great.
My dad was a book collector. He had 22,000 books in his basement.
22,000.
22,000.
Now that's a library. I've got about 7,000.
Yeah. I had
22 is a real library.
I had 6,000 when we left Vermont. I had to give away 3,000 because we live in a floating home now in Portland, and boy, it was like killing my children. I mean, giving away 3,000 of your books. It's.
I think it's hereditary. My dad was an inveterate collector of books as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Now, to the topic of the draft.
Yeah,
I have for a long time been arguing that if we had national service in the United States, we would not have invaded Iraq, and B, I lived in Germany for a year, so I have some firsthand experience with this, and I also helped start what is now the largest charity in Israel, Or Shalom,
a
community for abused kids in Israel. And I'm very familiar with their system there as well. And countries that have mandatory national service, and in both those cases, more so in Germany than in Israel, in both those cases there are non-military options. In fact, in Germany they encourage the non-military option. It's a great help to many of the nonprofits. The year that I lived in Germany, I was working with a nonprofit there, and I'd say 10% of our staff were people who were working there instead of being in the military. It number one, provides a rite of passage, which I think we desperately lack in our society. I don't think confirmation in the Catholic Church or even a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah anymore in Judaism is enough to feel that you've passed through, or graduating from high school definitely doesn't do it anymore now that, you know, it seems like everybody needs a college degree. So it provides a rite of passage, number one. Number two, it provides a bond to country. Hey, country has given me something. I have to give something back. Number three, it breaks people out of their provincial worldview, gets them out to see the country or see the world. And number four, gives them some new skills. I think that national service is something that should be mandatory. And many of the conservatives that I talk to, all of the libertarians that I talk to say, what, you want to take away my liberties? And from reading your book on the draft, it seems like you and I are singing the same song.
And Bill Buckley, too. I quote from his book, Gratitude, where he also – now, he didn't believe in the military. He believed in a national service civilian.
I know. I interviewed Bill Buckley years ago for one of my books, and was a junkie for firing.
Yeah, no, I don't – you know, as I mentioned in my book, I mean, George Washington Washington signed the Conscription Act of 1792. So anyone who argues that the concept of national service required national service is somehow un-American, they first have got to argue with George Washington.
Well, and even before that, I mean, Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote, you know, when the first draft of the Constitution was written,
yes.
Madison sent it off to Jefferson, who was in Paris at that time, and Jefferson sent it back saying, I will get the Virginia delegation to shoot this thing down if you don't add to it a Bill of Rights, which includes a ban on standing armies and a requirement that every able-bodied man from 17 to 47 be part of a national militia.
Yeah.
Which is the Second Amendment now.
Yes. So, I mean, we agree on this issue, although I, rather than the German method of I argue, since I happen to think we need more troops as well, that the military should have first pick, but they won't need nearly as, you know, obviously most of the people who would be called up wouldn't be needed, even in an expanded military.
But what if somebody doesn't want to be picked? I mean, what if you've got somebody who's a conscientious objector?
There's always a conscientious objector category. Most people, I believe that most people, if it's a national conscription, if it becomes tradition, that most people accept their responsibility and the military would get the pick of the most physically fit and best grade.
Okay, so we've got 20 seconds here, Tony. How do you,
yeah.
with the Republicans and me with the Democrats, how do we get this into law?
I fear that we're going to have to wait until things get worse before the public gets aroused, right? I've been doing interviews on this, and everybody dislikes the idea. It's you, me, and Charlie Rangel, I'm afraid,
yeah.
right now.
Yeah, okay. Well, okay. It's interesting to find an area of convergence with Tony Blankley.
It
I never thought
it
could happen.
It.
Yeah, great talking with you, Tony. American Grit is the book, What It'll Take to Survive and Win in the 21st Century. Thanks, Tony, for
Thank
dropping
you.
By. Good talking with you. 27 minutes. Past the hour, 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com for a free live chat room. Back with your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to flee. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. Well, here I sit in this rice paddy, wondering about Big Daddy, and I know that Lyndon loves me so. Yet how sadly I remember way back yonder in November when he said I'd never have to go. But Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to flee.
Yeah.
Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese.
Yeah, kind of blew it there. Kind of blowing it in Iraq. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Chuck Schumer talking about the governors who are saying, I don't want to. All of the governors who by coincidence are going to be candidates for the Republican presidency. He's saying, sorry, guys, it's not multiple choice. You don't get to say, well, I'll have a little of this and a little of that. It's not like a buffet. This should be particularly interesting. You know, Thursday and Friday this week. Day after tomorrow on Friday, I will be doing this show live from the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., CPAC. It's the fourth year or fifth year in a row that I've been at the CPAC radio row. It will be me and 40 or 50 right-wing talk show hosts. And more often than not, as they shovel the guests toward me, they have no idea what they're in for. And it's going to be just great fun. Every 15 minutes, a new crazy. I am so looking forward to it. By the way, one story, and then we're going to pick up your calls. I know there's a whole bunch of people who want to get on and comment about Tony and some of the things that were said and all the issues of the day. Fascinating article over at the Huffington Post, and I'm sorry I don't have it right up in front of me, so I can't credit the author, who certainly deserves the credit for it. And I will get it before the end of the show and share it with you. But the point is that my understanding, your understanding, apparently most members of Congress's understanding of how the filibuster works was wrong. And this is shocking because for for, you know, a year on this for several years on this program, but particularly over the last year, I've been, you know, making jokes about somebody needs to go to the governor's mansion in California and stand outside by the mailbox, and when that monthly stash of testosterone comes from Mexico for Arnold, you know, steal it and take it to Washington, D.C. and fill up a syringe, and when Harry Reid isn't looking, shoot him in the butt with it. You know, come on, Harry, make him filibuster, make him stand there and talk for hours and hours. And many of you have called his office and said, you know, damn it, do it. Well, apparently he has heard from us and decided to educate us. And it turns out that the rule on filibusters doesn't say that the party filibustering actually has to speak. All they have to do is periodically, the president of the Senate, which is a rotating position, I mean, technically it's the vice president, but in reality it's only the vice president twice a year. In reality it's, you know, whoever happens to be filling in as president of the Senate that day. The president of the Senate periodically has to say, okay, is there a majority for cloture? Is there a majority to end debate? And if there's not, then they all just continue to sit there. So if we were to look at a modern-day filibuster, what you would hear is Muzak on C-SPAN, and as you scan the galleries, you might see two or three members of the Senate, you know, presumably at least the one Republican who is filibustering, sitting there reading a Stephen King novel. They don't have to read. So people say, well, wait a minute. What about Strom Thurmond back in the 60s when he was so opposed to the civil rights legislation and he stood there for 30 hours and he had the pizzas brought in and he had the cot he was sleeping on and he had a bucket he was peeing in and the whole thing? He did that for theater. He did that because he actually thought he could get the American people behind him. He chose to do that. The way that a filibuster works is that they simply say, you don't have enough votes to close debate, and we're just going to sit here. We don't have to say anything. Now, this to me was just, you know, the forehead slap of the week. And it raises the question, if that's the way it works, why the hell have a filibuster? Why not invoke the nuclear option as the Republicans were talking about doing last year or 2 years ago when Sam Alito's nomination was before the Congress? Why not just do away with it? It's an do one of two things. One of two things has to happen. Either make the filibuster, you must talk, and if you stop talking for more than a five-minute period out of any 1 hour, then that is considered an abrogation of the filibuster. Either do it the old-fashioned way that we all understood filibusters to work, and maybe they did at some point back in the 20s or 30s or 50s or whatever. I mean, the filibuster rule itself actually wasn't even put into law until, I believe, 1917. Either do that or say, why do we have this thing? This is an anachronism. This is silly. This is stupid. Let's just do away with it. The Democrats have more than 51 votes. We don't need no stinking filibuster. Blow it up and do away with it. Tell your friends. Contact Congress. I mean, this is a big deal. The filibuster we thought we had, Harry Reid, who we thought was wimping out, turns out he apparently wasn't wimping out. That we all, including, you know, I've had at least a dozen elected members of Congress on this show saying, you know, yeah, we want Harry Reid to demand a filibuster, to demand people to stand there and talk. Apparently, if the information over at Huffington Post is right, and it looks like a very well-researched blog, apparently we all had it wrong. Pretty amazing. Dave in Grandy, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was listening to your debate with Tony, and Tony says that he's in favor of not censoring policy discussions, but he is in favor of censoring, the release of top secrets or whatever. My problem is what happens when, if in the case of something like the NSA wiretapping program, which is arguably unconstitutional, that if where a policy gets a top secret stamp slapped on it, and then you can't discuss it anymore.
Well, that was my whole point. We don't have a declared war. Congress never declared war. Congress has to declare war. And when you have a declared war, then presumably Congress then passes legislation, you know, tragically like the Alien Sedition Acts. I mean, that was the wrong way to do it, but presumably passes legislation that changes the rules of the game with regard to classified information, and you clearly determine what's classified. I don't think that an administration should get to pick and choose this stuff. I think that this is the province of the legislative branch. Congress carries out the laws that are passed by the legislative branch, but that's why it's called the legislative branch. They make the laws, and the executive branch's job is to execute the laws, is to carry them out. So, you know, I think, you know, with all respect to Tony, and again, he's not here to defend himself, so I'm not going to, you know, carry on a debate with him. But I think broadly speaking, this issue is wrongly framed. I don't think that we're at war. I think we're at mess. You know, we don't have a legitimate war. And if Congress decides that they're going to declare a war against a sovereign nation, because you don't declare wars against groups. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is Osama bin Laden and his merry band, they were criminals. It was like Tim McVeigh. Did we declare a war against Tim McVeigh? It was an act of terrorism. He killed a couple hundred people. He blew up a building. How different was that? I mean, in scale slightly, but he was also a Christian crazy. He thought he was doing it because it was going to bring about the end of the United States and maybe bring back Jesus. I mean, the parallels are mind-boggling. Bill Clinton never said, we're at a war against Christian terrorism. No, we're not at a war. This is a PR stunt. Kevin in Santa Fe listening on KTRC. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air, Kevin.
I was listening to you earlier, and you were just arguing with this fellow about whether or not it's war, and it just reminded me of when they were talking about prosecuting these guys for war profiteering as a war crime, that they pointed out that it was not a war, and it had never been declared a war. And it's like when there's a chance of prosecution, they'll say it's not a war, but this guy was arguing with you that it was a war, and I just found it another one of those points of duplicity.
Yeah, and interesting point. It's the old, you know, cake and eat it too trick, and ain't going to fly. By the way, in our next hour, Marjorie Cohn is going to be with us, the president of the National Lawyers Guild and the author of several books on the topic of prosecuting the Bush war criminals. It'll be interesting to get her take on this in the most recent update. Rudy in West Bloomfield, Michigan. I remember Bloomfield Hills. I've been there.
Okay. Tom,
yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, I originally had two questions, and I now have three. I'll give them to you, and I'll get off.
Okay.
Number one, yesterday I saw a guy in a pickup truck in front of me on his back window, American flag decal, and it said, if you want to keep your job, buy American, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How about bringing the jobs back so we can buy American?
It's a necessary precursor to buying American.
Yeah.
Go into Walmart and try to buy American.
Exactly. The second thing, what the hell do we need Democratic parties and Republican parties? Why can't we have politicians working for the good of the country and good of the people?
Well, the benefit of the parties is that you and I can join them, we can infiltrate them, and we can influence their policy. If we don't, if we all play passive and we watch TV and we don't show up, then you're right. There's no value in the parties. If we take over those parties, we can take over America.
Okay. The third question. You played the music, kind of sounded like folk music or country western music. Why is it all the liberal programs, they play this country music, this folk-sounding music, rock and roll? I always thought as liberals as being hip. Why? I never hear any jazz, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, something.
You know, I love jazz, and Charlie Parker is brilliant. You know, it's Charlie Mingus is actually my all-time favorite. I don't know. You'll have to take that up with my wife, Louise. She does our bumpers. Her email address is over at our website. Maybe if you can find a good one. I mean, you know, there's certain criteria. It's got to be kind of upbeat and relevant and all that kind of thing. But I, you know, I think we're doing pretty good. I like our music. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
You might have been a villain. your family. It doesn't matter what she was, it's what she is, and what she is is what you are.
9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. You are in the Democracy Zone. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., our accredited White House and Congressional and Pentagon and U.N. and everything else, every badge in the world hanging around her neck. Ellen Ratner on the line with us. Ellen, I'm looking at these opinion polls. 73%, according to the Washington Post ABC poll, say that they want... that Obama is trying to compromise Republican leaders. Only 34% believe the Republicans are. New York Times, CBS, pretty much identical numbers. Fox News, 68% say Obama has sincerely tried to reach out to Republicans. Only 33% believe the Republicans are negotiating.
Republicans have a problem.
Yeah, tell me about it. What's going
on
here?
Well, they have a problem because of perception. But I'll tell you something. You know, you don't have me on the show to be tattled around or whatever. We're noticing, although I think we'll get a lot tonight, tonight is the, what we call Address to Congress, or also known as State of the Union, even though officially it's not a State of the Union this year.
Why is it
part of the constitutional responsibility?
That's a question. Why is it? Because the Constitution does require that every year the president shall report on the State of the Union.
He hasn't been president long enough to really give a State of the Union, so he's fulfilling his constitutional responsibility by giving this address. But we have been calling around, and we've done this every year, so I have some measure in which to do it. Democrats are not wanting to talk. They just don't want to talk right now. And Bob May and I were talking about this. Why aren't members talking? And he said, listen, he thinks the word has been going out. You know, if you're not going to talk exactly on message, then actually don't participate.
Hmm. And what's on message mean?
Well, on message means, you know, just exactly the talking points they give out. And I think that's right. We have had Republicans very eager to talk, but the Democrat members of the House are not so eager to talk. Now, I'm sure there'll be a lot of them there tonight for FaceTime with television, et cetera.
Sure.
You've never seen a politician that doesn't like FaceTime.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a little different this year on that front. We are expecting that he is going to give Robert Gibbs said today that the speech is going to provide a sober assessment about where we are and the challenges we face. He said, because he's only 1 month in terms, he's spared to utter the phrase State of the Union. Now, Bernanke today he's the Federal Reserve Chair, and he was in front of the Senate banking, and he said that the economy is undergoing a severe contraction, but he is saying that there is the substantial declines in the prices of energy and other commodities and the growing margin of economic slack have contributed to lessening of inflation pressures, and he is saying that he sees resumption of growth projected for the second half of the year, and that he begins to see some things happening in 2010. Now, Tom, I just have to tell you, I hope he is right. I will do my last whatever. I will take you out to dinner anywhere in the United States if he's right. I'll fly to you, but I just don't see it.
I don't either, but let's just translate this into English for our listeners for a moment, Ellen. The reality is that people are not buying cars right now, but their cars are still wearing out. People are not buying houses right now, but the average American moves every 7 years, maybe every 5 years now. Last time I looked, it was every 7 years. That was a few years back. People need to move, you know, jobs and things like that. Their clothes are wearing out. They're not buying new clothes. Their dishes are getting broken. They're not buying new dishes. Their dishwasher, their washing machine, their dryers, they're all getting old and decrepit. They're not buying major appliances. Right across the board, Americans have stopped buying things, and that is creating demand, pent-up demand. At some point, the economy, that tipping point, that threshold is going to be hit. Now, consider the average lifetime of a car in the United States these days around 7-8 years. At least through the first owner. when that tipping point is hit, it's going to start driving the economy in a very positive direction, no matter what, almost regardless of policies. And so between the stimulus that's happening and that pent-up demand, we will come out of this, and we'll come out of this quite well. The question is, are we going to come out of it in 1 year, in 3 years, or in 7 years? I mean, you know, we came out of the Great Depression. By 1936, we were you know, in a large chunk out of it, and then Roosevelt took the advice of the Republicans in 37 and cut back on the programs, and boom, you know, the economy dropped a whole bunch of points, and it took them 2 years to dig back out of that hole again. But that's what happens when you listen to Republicans. My take on it, my guess is that we've got at least 2 years of this left, maybe three. But you're saying that Geithner?
Geithner.
Geithner.
No, but today it wasn't Geithner. Today it was Bernanke.
Okay, so you're saying Bernanke is saying 12 months. I think that's incredibly optimistic.
Yeah. And you know what? Remember how once every couple weeks I always read you the various reports, and when I read you a report, it'll say, yes, but economists predicted only thus?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the issue. Economists predicted only X, Y, or Z.
Right. Right.
And I just don't see it either.
Yeah.
But, hey, what am I? I mean,
yeah.
I did, however, I want to give myself some credit. I did, when my trip to Cleveland in July, wrote an article called Is America Cleveland, and talked about how the infrastructure problems and all the other problems was picked up by Crane's business. But I didn't listen to myself. Had I listened to myself, I would have taken some money out of the market. But I didn't listen to myself.
I think it's heading for six and maybe five. But, you know, until we have a fundamental change in our industrial policy in the United States, our trade policy, our manufacturing policy, this isn't going to get a whole lot better. We've got some structural problems here that are really substantial. Ellen Ratter with the talk.
I agree with you 100%. And so we will be State of the Union, or, as they say, the address.
Great. I look forward to getting your thoughts on it. I really do. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. We'll check in with you tomorrow, Ellen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Let's check in. Let's do a reality check here on what's going on with both the Bush administration, the state of law here in the United States, and the many criminals associated with the George W. Bush administration, now, thankfully, part of the past in our country. Marjorie Cohn on the line with us. Marjorie, MarjorieCohn.com, her website. She's a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, president of the National Lawyers Guild, the author of the forthcoming book, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Marjorie, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Tom.
Or I should say professor. Welcome to the show. Pleased to have you with us. We are hearing noises out of the Bush administration that, you know, to cliche it down, are kind of let the past be the past, live and let live, stuff like that. What's really going on?
You mean out of the Obama administration?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah.
I know. It's hard to remember that we are in a new administration. We've been in the other one for so long. Yes, Obama has been pressured a lot by Congress, by polls showing that two-thirds of the American people want investigations of crimes during the Bush administration. Half of those people want criminal investigations. And Obama has an agenda that he wants to, understandably, wants to get done. The economy is number one. And then, of course, we have these wars that we're fighting, health care, et cetera. He would evidently like to put this on the back burner. In fact, Scott Horton has written an article in The Nation, and he says that he's talked to senior advisors from the Obama administration who readily admit it may be the key to long-term resolution of a series of questions surrounding the abusive extension of presidential power, but it is clearly a back burner issue for them, something better addressed near the end of his first term, or better still, during a second term. So Obama says nobody's above the law. People should be prosecuted if they have violated the law. But generally speaking, he's more interested in looking forward than backwards. I'm not sure that he is going to be able to hold off these prosecutions. And in fact, we have two proposals, one from John Conyers to set up a commission and one from Patrick Leahy to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Conyers is more concerned about building a case to form a basis for prosecutions, and Leahy is concerned with getting the truth out and maybe giving immunity to people. But regardless, if there is a commission that does investigations, and I have to say, in all honesty, that the case against Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld and Rice and John Yoo and Jay Bybee has been made. It's out in the public domain. In fact, I did it in my book, Cowboy Republic. Many people have done it. But if there's a commission that has subpoena power and establishes on the record these violations, and then that leads to the appointment of a special prosecutor, then Obama's off the hook because it would come through Congress. What happened, just a little bit of history. After Watergate, the Congress passed the Independent Counsel statute to prosecute high government officials for serious crimes. But then when Ken Starr used that Independent Counsel statute in a witch hunt to go after Bill Clinton, and which resulted in his impeachment, although not removal, the Congress let the Independent Counsel statute expire of its own terms. And so the power to appoint an independent counsel or a special independent prosecutor then went back to the Attorney General. So now the Attorney General has the obligation to appoint a special prosecutor if three things are satisfied. Number one, there's evidence of crime. Number two, there is a conflict of interest. In other words, the Department of Justice itself might be implicated, and so there would be a conflict of interest if it was investigating itself. And number three, it would be in the public interest to do these investigations. All three of those requirements have been met, which means that Eric Holder, the new Attorney General, should appoint a special prosecutor. But of course, this has become very political. Obama wants to get things done. He's still trying to achieve bipartisanship, even though many people think that might be a pipe dream. And he would like to avoid this, but he may not be able to as things continue to come out, including this imminent report, this report that may be released from the Office of Professional Responsibility, which was initiated under Bush, which evidently excoriates John Yoo, Jay Bybee, and Stephen Bradbury, former lawyers with the Justice Department, for their infamous torture memos.
And yet, yesterday, Karl Rove was subpoenaed to testify before Congress, and he failed to show up.
Right, and it's going to be
nothing has happened
if they
as far
claim
as
executive privilege, because this is a former executive. Right. So what is the benefit for the former executive? Bush is no longer president, claiming executive privilege.
The argument they make is that any executive doesn't want his secrets or his secret conversations to come out at any point in the future. Otherwise, he wouldn't have those conversations. I mean, that it would have an inhibitory effect.
That's true. So, I mean, you know, Obama is between the rock and the hard place, not just about this, but about a number of other so-called national security issues. And he's certainly being pushed from the right, and he's got to be pushed from the left, or he's going to continue to move from the right to, from the center to the right, and reaffirm Bush policies, which he's done in a couple of instances. We've seen with the state secrets privilege. I'm sure you've talked about that, and now saying that. Decision to of the Supreme Court to allow Guantanamo detainees the right to habeas corpus doesn't apply to detainees at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan.
Right. Here's the thing that baffles me. We're talking with Professor Marjorie Cohen, professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, president of the National Lawyers Guild, author of Cowboy Republic. Yeah, that's what I thought. And the new book coming out, and this is, you know, get over to your favorite bookstore and order it, because Marjorie's books are incredible. Rules of Disengagement, Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Marjorie, there's no, as far as I know, there's no statute of limitation on murder. Is that right?
There's no statute of limitations on murder, and under international law, there's no statute of limitations on torture either. I believe there's an 8-year statute of limitations domestically under our either our torture statute or War Crimes Act. But one of the things that John Conyers is trying to do is to lift the statute of limitations, because if this gets put off until Obama's second term, and a lot of this torture took place in, say, 2003, then the statute of limitations might have run. So important to extend that before the statute of limitations runs out.
Yeah, that was my question. I mean, I've seen a number of very smug Republicans on the talk shows going, well, yeah, this will get investigated, and by the time it does, the statute of limitations will have run out, so why even bother?
Well, you can extend the statute of limitations if it's extended before the statute of limitations runs out, in other words, before the 8 years from the time the crime was committed until the prosecution lapses. So,
right.
So that is not a problem. If there's a will, there's a way to extend the statute of limitations.
So the two ways that this might come about are, number one, this report coming out of the executive branch might force the executive branch to act. The other being that Congress might bring so much evidence to the fore that either Congress, although they don't have direct police powers, but they can hand it off to the Justice Department, may act, or Congress, it may be so obvious that the executive through the Justice Department would have to act. Do I have that right?
Yeah, either the Attorney General will appoint a special prosecutor, or Congress will pass a new independent counsel statute, which will set up a procedure for appointing a special prosecutor. And the independent counsel statute that Ken Starr used, that, as I said, is no longer in effect,
a federal prosecutor could
require that the Chief Justice appoint the special prosecutor.
Oh, that would be a disaster.
Three judges.
John Roberts, that would be a disaster. Yeah, Marjorie, we have just a half a minute left. What can our listeners do to encourage this process?
Well, one thing you can do is read this statement, which is at NLG.org, the National Lawyers Guild, where nearly 40 organizations, including the National Lawyers Guild, are calling on Eric Holder to appoint a nonpartisan independent special counsel to immediately commence a prosecutorial investigation of Bush, Cheney, and the attorneys, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, et cetera, from the ex-Department of Justice attorneys whose memo sought to justify torture. And we say that we don't want to wait for a panel or a truth commission. This needs to be conducted by a prosecutor now. It's at NLG.org.
Great. NLG, as in NationalLawyersGuild.org. Check it out. Marjorie Cohen, Professor Marjorie Cohen, professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, president of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohen, Cohen.com as well, but NLG.org. Thank you, Marjorie.
My pleasure, Tom.
Thank you, Professor. Great having you on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you.
Thursday and Friday of this week, I'll be at CPAC, CPAC.org, if you want to see the whole lineup of all the conservative, you know, I started to say conservative crazies, but the fact of the matter is a lot of these people are really well-intentioned. They're just, well, nuts. But, you know, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have a great time. We'll be doing Radio Row from the Conservative Political Action Conference Thursday and Friday in Washington, D.C. on March 7th. That's Saturday. I think it's a week from Saturday. I don't have a calendar in front of me, and I'm lousy with dates and times. But anyhow, Saturday, March 7th, we're doing a three-hour cruise with AM 1090, KPTK, Progressive Talk Station in Seattle, noon to 3 on the Royal Argosy. And also there's a gig afterwards, a meet-and-greet gig afterwards, and I believe that there are still tickets available for that, or there may be tickets available for that. I think the cruise might be sold out, but you can find out the whole thing over at AM 1090 Seattle, so just check that out for the details. On March 19th, I'll be in Chicago. I'm debating Michael Medved. This is a debate sponsored by Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT, and AM and FM, actually. They've got a whole bunch of FM stations there as well. And you can get tickets to that. And, hey, show up. We need a good cheering section. We need a peanut gallery. Chicago's, with an S, chicagosprogressivetalk.com. And then on May 2nd, I'll be in Denver, Colorado. I am keynoting the Green Festival. And these Green Festivals are a hoot. I've keynoted the Green Festivals in San Francisco, in Seattle, in Los Angeles. I'm forgetting all of them. I've done four or five of them now. And typically 10,000-15,000 people will come through these things. And, you know, 500 people, a couple hundred people will show up for the talks, maybe sometimes as many as 1,000. And that should be a lot of fun. I'll be there Saturday the 2nd. If you want information on that, Green Festivals, and that's with an S, .org. Crazy stuff going on in the world. You think Facebook is getting out of control? This is bizarre. In a Starbucks in Bradenton, Florida. This wasn't you, Armin, was it? Armin's a regular caller. In a Starbucks in Bradenton, this guy walks up to a guy using his laptop, you know, using the local Wi-Fi, and he says, hey, can I check my Facebook account? And the guy says, no, come on, give me a break. So the guy snatches his laptop and goes charging out of there. Well, the two people in the parking lot, this is one of those good stories. This is one of those, no guns necessary, just good Americans. Two people in the parking lot tackled the guy and sat on him until a security guard showed up. And as far as we know, he did not get onto his Facebook account. So, c'est la vie. What can you say? 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And David in Keene, New Hampshire, listening on WKVT. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I was listening earlier. Well, I've been listening the whole time, but I was listening earlier when you had, his name escapes me, buddy. He used to be on the McLaughlin group.
It was Tony Blankley.
Tony Blankley, right. And I was just going to say, when he was speaking about the war, I don't know. A lot of people I know, and I've heard it from just regular people, that they think the war was about, like, controlling oil.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. We had on last week the guy who sued Dan Klayman, Larry Klayman, excuse me, who sued the Cheney Energy Commission. Now, keep in mind, Dick Cheney was given two jobs when George Bush came into office. Those two jobs were, number one, to keep track of national security, you know, to make sure that we were safe, and number two, to create an energy commission. So on the national security part, when Richard Clark and everybody else were running around with their hair on fire saying 9/11 is going to happen, 9/11 is going to happen, Cheney fell asleep on that. He failed that. He helped blow up our country, in my humble opinion. And number two, his energy commission met in secret, and the only people invited were oil company executives. Larry Klayman, who runs Judicial Watch, which is a right-wing group. I mean, these are the guys who busted Bill Clinton for Monica Lewinsky. They initiated the original Jennifer Flowers lawsuit that led right to Monica Lewinsky. Larry Klayman sued Dick Cheney, and what he got out of that lawsuit were the actual documents from February and March of 2001. Now, this was long before 9/11. This was a half a year before 9/11. the documents from the Energy Commission in which they were carving up the country of Iraq into 112 different oil fields. They had a list of 38 different countries that might want to buy that oil, a list of almost 40 different individual companies, and they were deciding which oil fields they were going to sell to which companies from which countries and how they could get political advantage from doing that. Now, that's a matter of record. So, yeah, there was a big piece of oil involved in the invasion of Iraq. In fact, I thought it was really ironic. The original acronym, the original name of the invasion of Iraq? It was Operation Iraqi Liberation. Now, tell me what those three letters would be if you did it as an acronym. Oh, he's dropped off the line. Operation Iraqi Liberation, O-I-L. About 2 days before the invasion, some reporter said, hey, wait a minute. Operation Iraqi Liberation? And all of a sudden it became Operation Iraqi Freedom. Oof. Which is almost as bad, right? It is an oof. So, yeah, I think that there was an element of oil to it. The biggest element, though, was in 1999 when he was still governor of Texas, George W. Bush told Mickey Herskowitz, the guy who wrote his autobiography, if he got elected, he'd invade Iraq for political advantage.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 34 minutes, coming up on 35 minutes and 2 seconds here before the hour, or after the hour, rather. Tom Hartman here with you. And the piggies are at it again. The big piggies in the starched white shirts, you know.
That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every 4 and 3, you've got a pile of this
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dirt.
And running U.S. Airways. I fly a lot on a lot of different airlines. Over on United Airlines, you see some passengers and occasionally a staff person wearing these little, the little plastic bracelets that say Fire Glenn. He's the CEO. U.S. Air, apparently they have the same problem. Sully Sullenberg, right? Chesley Sully Sullenberg. You know the guy who landed the plane in the Hudson? 58-year-old pilot testifying before Congress today. Told the House Aviation Subcommittee that his pay has been cut 40% and his pension has been terminated and replaced with, quote, a promise worth pennies on the dollar, end quote, from the federally created Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. This is what happens when you allow companies to play monopoly. This is what happens when you take industries that should be operating under reasonable and strict regulations and allow them to work in a completely unregulated environment, a laissez-faire environment. This is the general insanity of it. Here, do you want your life in the hands of somebody who doesn't know what the hell they're doing? I mean, as Sullenberger said, a lot of good pilots who know what they're all about, they're leaving the business. because they can't make a living at it. It's hard work. It's long hours. It's you're away from home a lot. Hey, there's easier work close to home. As Michael Moore pointed out in, I think it was Fahrenheit 9/11, it might have been another one of his movies, a lot of these commuter airlines, and I don't want to dump specifically on the one that just crashed and killed 49, 50 people, you know, just in the last couple of weeks, but a lot, and you know, there's questions about what caused that, but a lot of these commuter airlines are starting their pilots out. I'm not talking about the flight attendants or the guy who's putting gas in the plane. They're starting the pilots out at a pay that's below that of the manager of a Burger King. Not the owner of the Burger King, the manager, the guy who says, you want fries with that? This is downright bizarre. Downright bizarre. This is how, and people call the show and they go, oh, you're an advocate for the unions. Why, you want to put all the companies out of business? No! I don't think a company should be in business if they can't pay a decent wage. Oh, but we've, you know, we got to have a race to the bottom, you know. Everybody's got, you know, we compete with the Chinese. They make a buck and a half an hour. Well, then let's have tariffs so we don't compete with the Chinese. So we don't compete with the Chinese. This is nuts. Solly Sullenberger, he says, well, this is a veteran controller, actually, Patrick Harton. He said, people don't survive landings on the Hudson River. And he said, you know, this is exceptional. This is absolutely exceptional. Why? This guy's brilliant. He's a very, very competent pilot. And what has U.S. Air done? They've cut his pay 40%. And I guarantee you the senior executives at that company are making good 6- and 7-figure salaries. Screw them. And all the other ones across corporate America, we have a culture of greed in this country that says that somehow if somebody wears a white shirt and a tie to work every day, that you know, millions of dollars should rain down on them because they're so brilliant and so talented. I'm sorry, they are just very good con men. They've figured out how to run the game, and it's like a 3-card Monte game. You can't tell me that CEOs in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s and the first half of the 1980s, when they were making a couple $100,000 a year, that those CEOs were less competent, less committed, less hardworking, less innovative, less brilliant, less creative than CEOs are today. In fact, I would submit to you that $30, $40, and $50 million salaries today have the exact opposite effect. They make those CEOs less committed and less competent and less creative because they don't have to, you know, they figure, hey, the company goes down, what the hell? I got mine. Just look around. It's happening all over the place. So, anyhow, Zirant du jour, Drew in Cape May, New Jersey. Hey, Drew, you're on the air. What's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Actually, I agree with what you just said about the CEOs completely, but I'm talking about other people that are getting paid a lot. I guess since 1989, the Congress have been giving themselves automatic pay raises just by not voting against a pay raise.
That's right.
And,
To give them credit, it's basically a cost of living. It's just very slightly more than keeps up with inflation.
But isn't it like $4,400 a year? I mean, it's... You know, and I can understand, but even if it's a cost of living increase, Nancy Pelosi made a big speech about how everyone's got to take a haircut.
Yeah, but see, if they're making $160,000, if you have a 3% inflation rate and you're making $100,000, $3,000 is cost of living. So actually they're making less than inflation. But if your point is that, you know, cut back their pay until they get their act together, I think that there's a lot of sentiment for that in the United States. The tragedy is that, you know, paying a member of Congress $167,000 or $169,000 is meaningless. It's got nothing to do with the federal budget deficit.
Well, I know, but it's a drop in the bucket. But, you know, I think Clinton said to lead by the power of example, not the example of power. And as a gesture.
Clinton, who gets $100,000 for a speech or $500,000?
Yeah, well,
$1 million?
I'm not saying he's not making money. But
Jimmy Carter is a good role model for these guys.
But the sentiment is that if you're going to ask the unions to take cuts and you want people to take these things, and I don't think unions should take cuts. Like,
Right.
I agree with you. But if you ask the American people to take a bite, you know, I think first and foremost, you got to say, look, I'm going to take my bites. I'm going to take my haircut first.
Yeah. Well, you do it in one of two ways. If you're just telling them to postpone their pay raise, there are actually some members of Congress who are refusing the pay raises, and you know they campaign on all that. That's cosmetic.
Of them,
that's not even lipstick on a pig. That is the beginning of a little bit of liner on the corner of the lips. If you really want them to take a pay cut, tell them to take the salary of a starting worker at the General Motors Oldsmobile plant in Lansing, Michigan, of $16,000 or $17,000 a year. Tell them to live on $17,000 a year.
Well, actually, that's kind of my point also with the House representatives. If they're supposed to represent the people, should they be making – hello?
Yeah.
Should they be making what the average –
Yeah, pay them the median income in the United States. The median income in the United States is what, $47,900, I think, or $48,000. It's in that neighborhood. It's under $50,000 a year. But that's not the point. The real problem here, Drew, that your righteous outrage, and I get it, is directed toward, is that the system is broken and the people are corrupt. And what's corrupting the people and what's broken about the system is not the paycheck they get. It's the lobbyists who are showing up to their office, handing them $10,000 and $20,000 and $50,000 and $100,000 checks. This is a billion-dollar industry giving money to members of Congress. And then there's the loophole that says that if you have inside information on stock, if you're Martha Stewart, you go to prison. If you're on Tom DeLay's staff, he had three guys in his staff sitting there all day long with computers doing day trading on inside information because there's an exemption for members of Congress. They can trade stock on inside information. Nobody else can, and they're the ones who make the laws. So they're making out like bandits. You wonder why Tom DeLay is running around with all this money. I mean, these guys, this is organized crime. We need to change the laws of how we fund elections in the United States.
I agree. I believe in the fair election. I believe that they were doing in Maine. And actually, New Jersey actually just ended it where you would get equal funds.
Yeah. Arizona has it. At the city level, we have it in Portland, Oregon. There's a number of communities that are doing this around the country. More need to. We have a fundamentally broken election system. The system
that definitely have an unlevel playing field because I mean it costs millions of dollars just to become a mayor.
Well, not only that. I mean, it costs $5-6 million to run for the United States Senate. Every morning, depending on where you are, it can cost a whole lot more than that. On average, every morning, every United States senator wakes up knowing that if they don't raise $20,000 by the end of that day, at the end of their 6-year term, they won't be a senator anymore.
And for that why they have 6 years so they wouldn't have to raise money every
year? That was the theory back in the 1790s. But it ain't the reality anymore, tragically. And of course in the House of Representatives they get elected every 2 years, and that's getting more and more expensive too. And these guys are raising and spending a hell of a lot more than they're making. That's where we need to be looking. Is a campaign finance reform. We need to look there fast.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Understand the load you have to bear. All a friend can offer is to try to take a share. Friends are all we have, and I just want to help you see. However hard it gets for you, you have that friend in me.
Welcome back to your radio support group for We the People of the United States of America. Ed in Hollywood, California. Hey, Ed, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Just the other elephant that seems to be sitting in the living room of these credit card companies that none of the mainstream media is talking about. And what they're doing is, for no reason at all, other than to, and what I was told by Citi, So I have a Citi credit card. They sent me a minimum payment that was twice what it normally had been, and I had to call them up, and they simply told me, I said, was I late? And I said, no. I said, did I go over my limit? No. I said, what's the problem? And she said, well, it looks like your interest rate went up from 6.5% to 24.5%. I said, why did that happen? And she said, because of the economy. No, it wasn't my credit that was bad. It's because the economy. And my friend told me the same thing happened to him with Avanta. He went from 3% to 27%, and his brother in Massachusetts, the same thing with his credit card company. And it seems like no one's talking about this. I know Christopher Dodd complained about it. But there should be some laws to cap these crazy interest rates. I mean, this is the wild, wild west. It really is with these credit cards.
No, it really is. And the actual correct and honest answer is not it's the economy. The actual, honest, correct answer is because we can.
Right.
I mean, they can get away with it. And you're absolutely right. It's why Bernie Sanders is calling for bringing back usury laws, you know, making it illegal to charge interest over a certain level.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, you know, it should happen. This is just so criminal, particularly these companies that take all our money and then jack up the interest rates on us. I mean, it's just wrong. But here's the simple answer, Ed, as to why Congress isn't doing anything about it. Because the credit card companies and the banks have billions of dollars and they make big campaign contributions.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is how they got the bankruptcy law passed in the first place. There's a bunch of Democrats who voted for the bankruptcy law. Joe Biden was among them. Totally disappointed me. I was horrified. But the bottom line is these guys have got big bucks, and you got to have big bucks to get elected, and you can't do the good stuff along with some of the bad stuff like the bankruptcy bill if you don't get reelected. Otherwise, you get Republicans in there who are more than willing to take everybody's money and do their bidding. And it's a disaster. And it's another argument for public financing of elections. Ed, thanks
absolutely.
Thanks for raising the topic. Well done and well said. Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. Continuing with the media. Recently, the media has been making daily links between the stock market declines and the policies of the Obama administration.
Right.
But the media never made such a linkage between Wall Street and the Bush administration until a year after a recession was confirmed. A year.
Right.
An international meltdown was in progress. Deficits, bailouts had become the norm. The integrity of the markets was put into question. And 8 years of Republican policies and their criminalization of government was completed. The media's claim of linkage between the two is not supported by any financial data, period. Just pillow talk from partisan commentators. The media, you know, every day, the Dow's down, oh, Barack did this. The Dow's up, no sounds. Dow's down, this could be Barack's policies creating this. You know, they're not like
Tim Geithner talked today.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's really absurd. Last night, I had one of those screaming at the television moments. I'm staying with a friend of mine, Ron Hartenbaum, here in Manhattan, and I was watching, we were watching CNN, and Ali Velshi, is that his name? Ali Velshi was on, and he had this chart of the last 10 years of the economy, of the Dow, not the economy, because the Dow is not the economy, but of Dow Jones Industrial Average. And he said, you know, the Dow is back to where it was in whatever the year was, 87 or 97, or I think it was 97. And what, you know, looking at it, I it was like there was this giant gap on the bottom in the grid that it was on, right? There's a giant gap on the bottom and then a somewhat smaller gap above that and then a smaller gap above that. And I looked at it and I said, that's a logarithmic scale, not a linear scale. So it didn't show the bubble. So it looked like the stock market kind of went up after 87 or 97, and then it kind of leveled off, and it just kind of leveled off, and then it crashed when Obama came into office or when Bush was leaving. And if you had shown that on a linear scale, an actual, you know, one square equals $1, it would be a completely different thing. A logarithmic scale is where the first increment equals 1 to 10. The second increment equals 1 to 100. The third increment equals 1 to 1,000. The fourth increment equals 1 to 10,000. And so what happens is all of the wild bumps, they all get evened out. And I'm going, Ali Velshi, why are you showing a logarithmic scale? And then they showed the Dow from the last 2 weeks, and it's on a linear scale rather than a log scale. And you know, the reason why, obviously, is, first of all, you know, most Americans weren't paying attention in high school to math. And if they were, they didn't remember. And they're not noticing this. They're just figuring, oh, these are the numbers. Hey, look at that. Oh, it's not so bad. You know, it's just a little bit of a bump. But if you were seeing it on a real scale, you'd say, you know, on a real actual linear scale, you'd say, holy cow, we had one hell of a bubble.
It's kind of like saying the best way to stop the deficits is to spend more so that Republicans can never do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, you know, now you're back into Jude Wodinski's, two Santa Claus theory and David Stockman's Star of the Beast theory of, you know, let's run the government into such bad debt that the Democrats can't have things like Social Security and national health care. I mean, it's just a crime. All the crimes that are the economic crimes that are being committed by this administration, not this administration, by the Bush administration, by the Republicans and a few of the conservative Democrats, frankly, I mean, let's just be honest about this, are abhorrent. They're over the top. They're wrong. They shouldn't have happened. They shouldn't be happening. They shouldn't. Anyway, tomorrow, if you like the idea of Jeffrey Dahmer babysitting the kids, you'll love the idea of Sumners and Geithner running Detroit. What? Craig Shirley, conservative, says that. Plus Suzanne Summers. We're going to talk about hormones and steroids, and this actually should be very interesting. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.